and by us in the same and only manner that they were ever won by any people since the days of Joshua, by boldly pursuing and striking the foe. What, under the blessing of Providence, I conceived to be the true organization of victory and military combinations to win this war, was declared in a few words by General Grant's message to General Buckner. I propose to move immediately upon your works. Lincoln, too, could praise Grant and the Lord for victories in the West, but the news came at a time when there was sickness in the house and, presently, sorrow. Robert was at Harvard, one of those rare ripe sort, his father called him once, that are smarter at about 5 than ever after. It was Willie, the middle son, and his mother's favorite, who was the studious member of the family. Tad, the youngest, could still neither read nor write at the age of 9. Now Willie lay sick with what the doctor said was bilious fever. He got better, then worse, then suddenly much worse, until one afternoon Lincoln came into the room where one of his secretaries lay half asleep on the couch. "Well, Nicolay," he said, "my boy is gone. He is actually gone." And then, as if having spoken the words aloud had brought their reality home to him, he broke into tears and left. Hard as it was for Lincoln to absorb the shock in this time of strain, the blow was even harder on his wife. All her life she had been ambitious, but in her ambition she had looked forward more to the pleasures than to the trials of being First Lady, only to discover once the place was hers that the tribulations far outnumbered the joys. In Richmond, Verena Davis could overlook, or anyhow seem to overlook, being referred to as a coarse Western woman, which was false. Mary Lincoln could not weather half so well being criticized for putting on airs, which was true. A fading Kentucky belle, she clung to her gentility, already sorely tried by 2 decades of marriage with a man who, whatever his political attainments, liked to sit around the house in slippers and shirt sleeves. She punctuated her conversation with "sir," and spent a great deal of money on dresses and bonnets and new furnishings for the antiquated White House. Washington was not what she had expected, its former social grace having largely departed with the southern-mannered hostesses, whose positions had been taken over by Republican ladies whose chief virtues were not social. Yet these disappointments were by no means the worst she had to bear. Her loyalty was undivided, but the same could not be said of her family, which had split badly over the issues that split Kentucky and the nation. A brother and a half-sister stayed with the Union. Another brother and 3 half-brothers went with the South, while 3 half-sisters were married to Confederates. This division of her family, together with her bluegrass manner, caused critics to say that she was 2/3 slavery and the other 1/3 secesh. The rumors were enlarged as the war continued. The president's enemies sought to make political capital with a whispering campaign, accusing Mrs. Lincoln of specific acts of treason, which at last reached such proportions that the matter was taken up by a congressional investigating committee. One morning her husband came unexpectedly into one of its secret sessions to announce in a sad voice, "I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, appear of my own volition before this committee of the Senate to say that I, of my own knowledge, know that it is untrue that any of my family hold treasonable communication with the enemy." That removed her from the reach of the committee, but it did not spare her the ridicule being heaped upon her almost daily in the opposition papers, which struck at the husband through the wife. And now, with all this burden on her, to lose her favorite child was altogether more than she could bear. She wept grievously and was often in hysterics. She could neither accept nor reject her sorrow, and between the two she lost her mental balance. Lincoln had Tad, whom he took more and more for his own and even slept with. He had, too, the day-long, sometimes night-long occupation of running the country. She had nothing, not even Lincoln, who did not help matters by leading her one day to a window and pointing to the lunatic asylum, as he said, "Mother, do you see that large white building on the hill yonder? Try and control your grief, or it will drive you mad, and we may have to send you there. A distracted wife was one among the many problems Lincoln faced. His main problem was still McClellan. During the weeks since the general first outlined the Urbana plan, much of what he called its brilliance had worn off, at least for Lincoln, who still had fears that it would expose the capital to capture. Again he told McClellan his doubts, and once more McClellan sought to allay them, this time by proposing to submit the plan to his 12 division commanders for a professional decision. They assembled March 8th, many of them hearing details of the plan for the first time. When the vote was taken, they favored it 8-4 and repaired in a body to the White House to announce the result to the president, whose objections thus were effectively spiked again. As he told Stanton, who shared his mistrust, "We can do nothing else than accept their plan and discard all others. We can't reject it and adopt another without assuming all the responsibility in the case of the failure of the one we adopt." One thing he could do, and did, that same day. The members of the Joint Committee had called on him the week before with a plan for reorganizing the Army of the Potomac into corps. This, they saw, would not only gain prestige for certain generals who had their favor, McDowell, for example, but would weaken McClellan's authority as general-in-chief, since, as the committeemen sought, corps commanders would take orders directly from Stanton. Lincoln saw other merits in the plan. For one thing, it would simplify the transmission of orders and lessen the burden on the young Napoleon. Besides, he was anxious to placate Wade and the others wherever he could. When he went to McClellan, however, to urge that it be effected and to get the general's recommendations for the appointments, McClellan told him that he had already thought it over and had decided that it would be best to wait until all the division commanders had been tested in combat before making his recommendations. Once more, Lincoln had been shown that he would lose in any face-to-face encounter with the general over military logic. So the following week, when he decided to act on the matter, he did so without consulting McClellan. Later that day, after having reported their vote on the Urbana plan, the division commanders learned that four of their number had been appointed to corps command: McDowell, E.V. Sumner, S.P. Heintzelman, and E.D. Keyes. Notification came in the form of a paper headed President's General War Order No. 2. Whatever elation this document produced in the breasts of the men thus elevated, it came as a terrible shock to McClellan, even though the earlier general war orders being numbered had indicated that there might well be others. The shock was mainly due to the fact that among the four who were raised to corps command, and would therefore have the principal responsibility under McClellan himself for executing the Urbana plan, three had voted against it in the balloting that morning. The officers he wanted had been held back. Franklin, for instance, who had spoken in favor of the sea route at the conference held while McClellan was in bed with fever, was not appointed, nor were any of the others among his protégés. Gentlemen and Democrats, he called them, who thought of war and politics as he did. He felt himself hobbled at the outset, held in check by a high council of Republicans friendly toward the enemies who were working for his ruin. If he had ever doubted that they were out to wreck him, any such doubts had been dispelled during the early morning hours of that same busy March 8th. He learned of whispered charges touching his honor as a soldier, and he learned of them from Lincoln himself, who had sent for him to come over to the White House after breakfast. As McClellan told it later, he found the president looking worried. There was a very ugly matter, Lincoln said, which needed airing. Again he hesitated, and McClellan, seated opposite, suggested that perhaps it would be best to come right out with it. "Well," Lincoln said, choosing his words cautiously at first, "there was an ugly rumor going round to the effect that the Urbana plan was conceived with the traitorous intent of removing its defenders from Washington, and thus giving over to the enemy the capital and the government, thus left defenseless." He added that the whole thing had a sound and look of treason. The word was out, and it brought McClellan straight up out of his chair, declaring that he would permit no one to couple the word treason with my name, and demanding an immediate retraction. "No, no," Lincoln said hastily, "he did not believe a word of it. He was only repeating what had been told him." Somewhat calmer, McClellan suggested caution in the use of language, and re-emphasized that he could permit no doubt to be thrown upon my intentions. Lincoln again apologized and let the matter go at that. McClellan left to round up his division commanders for a vote that would prove that the proposed campaign was militarily sound, then brought them back to announce their 8-4 support in Lincoln's presence. As far as McClellan was concerned, that settled it. He had shown him once and for all. But then, as soon as he turned his back, War Order 2 came dropping onto his desk, and he was upset all over again. The day had opened with charges of treason and closed with the appointment of unsympathetic officers to head the corps of the army he was about to take into battle. As he saw it, Lincoln had gone over to the scoundrels, bag and baggage. Or, in McClellan's words, the effects of the intrigues by which he had been surrounded became apparent. He did not see, then or ever, that he had helped to bring all this trouble on himself by not taking Lincoln into his confidence sooner. And if he had seen it, the seeing would not have made the end result any easier to abide. McClellan was never one to find ease in admission of blame. Nor did he see that Lincoln had not called him to the White House merely to insult him by repeating ugly rumors, that what he was really trying to tell him was that Wade and the others were powerful and vindictive men who would hurt him all they could, and with him the cause if they were not dealt with in some manner that would take some of the pressure off their anger. Whereas the young Napoleon, who had been before them and heard them accuse him of cowardice, was determined to yield them not a single military inch of the solid ground he stood on. Whatever they took from him they must take by force, with Lincoln's help. Already they had taken much, including his trust of Lincoln, and he could see that they were after more, with an excellent chance of getting it. Present troubles were grief enough, but as if they were not, there was added the following morning news of what had happened at Hampton Roads on the afternoon of that same crowded Saturday, March 8th. A single Confederate 10-gun vessel, steaming out of Norfolk on what had been planned as a trial run, made obsolete the navies of the world. Between noon and sunset of that one day, the strange craft, which resembled, some said, a terrapin with a chimney on its back, served graphic notice that the proud tall frigates and ships of the line, with their billowing sails and high wooden sides that could flash out 100-gun salvos, would soon be gone in all their beauty and obsolescence. She herself had been one of them once, the 350-ton, 40-gun U.S. steam frigate Merrimack, burned and scuttled in her berth when the Union forces abandoned Gosport Navy Yard the previous spring. She sank so quickly her hull and engines were saved from the fire, and Lieutenant John M. Brooks, CSN, went to Secretary Mallory with a plan for converting her into a sea-going ironclad, wherewith the tightening federal blockade might be lifted. Mallory approving, she was plugged, pumped out and raised, the salt mud swabbed out of her engines, and her hull cut down to the water's edge. While some workers were attaching a 4-foot iron ram beak to her prow, others were building amidships a slope-walled structure, 130 feet long and 7 feet tall, in which to house her guns, 2 6- and 2 7-inch rifles, and 6 9-inch smoothbores, the 2 lightest pieces being bound at the breech with iron hoops, shrunk on like the tires on wagon wheels, to strengthen them for firing extra-heavy powder charges. Another Brook innovation. Finally, they covered her all over, down to 2 feet below the waterline, with overlapping plates of 2-inch armor rolled from railroad iron at the Tredegar Works in Richmond. She was finished. What she lacked in looks, and she was totally lacking there, she made up for in her ability to give and take a pounding. However, she had faults more serious than her ugliness, faults which caused headshakings and predictions that she would be an enormous metallic burial case for her crew. For one, the weight of all that iron made her squat so low in the water, 22 feet, that she had to confine her movements to deep water channels. Not that she was much at maneuvering in the first place. Unwieldy as Noah's Ark, one of her officers called her. Her top speed was 5 knots, and what with her great length and awkward steering, it took half an hour to turn her in calm water. This was mainly because of her wheezy, antiquated engines, which had been condemned on the Merrimack's last cruise and had scarcely been improved by the fire and the months of immersion. Nevertheless, Mallory and her builders expected great things of her. Nothing less, in fact, than the raising of the blockade by the destruction of whatever attempted to enforce it. They renamed her the Virginia, recruited a large part of her 300-man crew from the Army, and placed her in the charge of Commodore Franklin Buchanan, the 62-year-old Father of Annapolis, so-called because, under the old flag, he had been instrumental in founding the Naval Academy and had served as its first superintendent. Some measure of Mallory's expectations of the Virginia was shown by the fact that he had given command of her to the ranking man in the whole Confederate Navy. When she steamed down Elizabeth River on her trial run at noon that Saturday, her inherent faults—low speed, deep draft, and sluggish handling—were immediately apparent. Her guns had not yet been fired, and workmen still swarmed over her superstructure, making last-minute adjustments. But as she came in sight of open water, Buchanan saw across the roads 5 warships of the blockade squadron lying at anchor, 3 off Fort Monroe and 2 off Newport News. The 3 were the Minnesota and the Roanoke, sister ships of the Merrimack, and the 50-gun frigate St. Lawrence. The 2 were the Congress, another 50-gun frigate, and the 30-gun sloop Cumberland. It was more than the Commodore could resist. He hove to off Craney Island, sent the workmen ashore, cleared the Virginia's decks for action, and set out north across the roads with his crew at battle stations. The trial run would be just that, all out. On the southern shore, from Willoughby Spit to Ragged Island, gray-clad infantry and artillerymen lined the beaches. They saw his intention and tossed their caps, cheering and singing Dixie. Across the water, from Old Point Comfort westward, men in blue observed it too, but with mixed emotions. They had heard that this strange new thing was being built, and now they saw her coming slowly toward them. To an Indiana volunteer watching her across 5 miles of water, she looked very much like a house submerged to the eaves, borne onward by a flood. It was wash day aboard the Federal warships, sailor clothes drying in the rigging. Yet there was plenty of time in which to get ready for what was coming so slowly at them. The Congress and the Cumberland cleared for action, and when the Virginia came within range, the former gave her a well-aimed broadside, which broke against the sloping iron with no apparent effect at all. Ports closed tight, she came on, biding her time as she closed the range, unperturbed and inexorable. Another salvo struck her, together with shots from the coastal batteries, with no more effect than before. Then her ports came open, swinging deliberately upward on their hinges to expose the muzzles of her guns. Turning, she raked the Congress with a starboard broadside and rammed the Cumberland at near right angles just under her fore rigging, punching a hole which one of her officers said would admit a horse and cart, except for the iron beak which broke off in her when the Confederate swung clear. The Cumberland began to fill, firing as long as a gun remained above water. Called on to surrender, her captain shouted, "Never! I'll sink alongside!" Presently he did just that, his flag still flying from the mainmast, defiant above the waves after the ship herself struck bottom. Horrified, the captain of the Congress slipped his cable and tried to get away before the ironclad could complete its ponderous turn, but ran aground in the attempt. The Virginia, held at 200-yard range by her deeper draft, raked the helpless ship from end to end until, her captain dead and her scuppers running red with blood, a lieutenant ran up the white flag of surrender. Buchanan ceased firing and stood by to take on prisoners, but the coastal batteries redoubled their fire under command of Brigadier General Joseph K. Mansfield, West Point 22. When one of his own officers protested that the enemy had the right to take possession unmolested once the Congress struck her flag, the crusty old regular replied, "I know the damned ship has surrendered, but we haven't." Two Confederate lieutenants were killed in this unexpected burst of artillery and musketry, and Buchanan himself was wounded. So were many of the Union sailors on the decks of the surrendered ship, including Buchanan's brother, a lieutenant who had stayed with the old flag and who presently died in the flames on the quarterdeck when the Virginia dropped back and retaliated by setting the Congress afire with red-hot cannonballs that started fires wherever they struck wood. By now, the three frigates off Old Point Comfort had started west to join the fight. Hugging the northern shore to avoid the rebel guns on Sewell's Point, however, the Roanoke and the St. Lawrence ran aground, and presently the Minnesota, left alone to deal with the Iron Monster, did likewise. It was well for her that it happened so, for the Virginia, having finished with the Congress, turned to deal with her erstwhile sister ship, and found that, the tide being on the ebb, she could not come within effective range. So she drew off across the roads to unload her wounded, survey her damage, and wait for the flooding of the tide tomorrow morning, when she intended to complete this first day's work by sinking the three grounded frigates. Her 21 killed and wounded, including Buchanan, were removed, after which the officers surveyed the effects of the fight on the ship herself. The damage, though considerable, was not vital. In spite of having been exposed to the concentrated fire of at least 100 guns, her armor showed only dents, no cracks, and nothing inside the shell was hurt. Outside was another matter. She had lost her iron beak, and two of her guns had had their muzzles blown off. Besides which, one of her crew later wrote, one anchor, the smokestack, and the steam pipes were shot away. Railings, stanchions, boat davits, everything was swept clean. All this seemed a small enough price to pay for the victory they had won that afternoon and the one they had prepared for completion tomorrow. Officers and men stayed up on deck, too elated to sleep, and watched the Congress burn. She lit up the roads from across the way and paled the second quarter moon, which came up early. From time to time, another of her loaded guns went off with a deep reverberant boom, but the big effect did not come until 1 o'clock in the morning, when her magazine blew up. After that, the Confederate crew turned in to get some sleep. Ashore, a Georgia private, writing home of the sea battle he had watched, exulted that the Virginia had invented a new way of destroying the blockade. Instead of raising it, she sinks it. Or I believe she is good at both, he added, for the one she burned was raised to a pretty considerable height when the magazine exploded. A telegram reached Washington from Fort Monroe within 2 hours of the explosion of the Congress, informing the War Department that the Confederates' indestructible floating battery had sunk two frigates and would sink three more tomorrow before moving against the fortress itself, after which there was no telling what might happen. Lincoln had his cabinet in session by 6:30, the prevailing gloom being broken only by the Secretary of War, who put on for his colleagues a remarkable display of jangled nerves. The jaunty Seward was glum for once, Chase was petulant, the President himself seemed quite unstrung, but Stanton was unquestionably the star of the piece. According to Wells, who did not like him, he was inexpressibly ludicrous, with his wild, frantic talk, action, and rage, as he sat down and jumped up, swung his arms, scolded and raved. The Virginia would change the whole character of the war, the lawyer statesman cried. She will destroy, seriatim, every naval vessel. She will lay all the cities on the seaboard under contribution. He would recall Burnside, abandon Port Royal, and notify the governors and municipal authorities in the North to take instant measures to protect their harbors. Then, crossing to a window which commanded a long view of the Potomac, He looked out and, trembling visibly, exclaimed, "Not unlikely we shall have a shell or a cannonball from one of her guns in the White House before we leave this room." Wells, who recorded with pride that his own composure was not disturbed, replied that Stanton's fear for his personal safety was unfounded, since the heavily armored vessel would surely draw too much water to permit her passage of Kettle Bottom Shoals. He doubted, in fact, that she would venture outside the capes. This afforded at least a measure of relief for the assembly. Besides, Wells said, the Navy already had an answer to the rebel threat. A sea-going ironclad of its own. Monitor was her name. She had left New York on Thursday and should have reached Hampton Roads last night. "How many guns does she carry?" Stanton asked. "Two," the naval secretary told him, and Stanton responded with a look which, according to Wells, combined amazement, contempt, and distress. The gray-bearded, brown-wigged Wells spoke truly. The Monitor had arrived the night before. She had not only arrived, she was engaged this Sunday morning before the cabinet adjourned to pray in church for the miracle which Stanton said was all that could save the eastern seaboard. And in truth it was something like a miracle that she was there at all. Coming south, she had run into a storm that broke waves over her, down her blower pipes and stacks, flooding her hold. Pumps were rigged to fight a losing battle, and the wind went down just as the ship was about to do the same. The fact was, she had not been built to stand much weather. She was built almost exclusively for what she was about to do. Engage the former Merrimack, rumors of which had been coming north ever since work on the rebel craft began in mid-July. There was a New York Swede, John Erickson, who thought he had the answer, but when he went before the naval board with his plan for an impregnable steam battery of light draft, the members told him that calculations of her displacement proved the proposed Monitor would not float. He persisted, however. "The sea shall ride over her, and she will live in it like a duck," he said, until at last they offered him a contract with a clause providing for refund of all the money if she was not as invulnerable as he claimed. Erickson took them up on that and got to work. Her keel was laid in October, 3 months behind the beginning of work on her rival, and she was launched within 100 days. As Wells had said, she had only 2 guns, but they were hard-hitting 11-inch rifles housed in a revolving turret, another Erickson invention, which gave them the utility of many times that number, though it caused the vessel to be sneered at as a tin can on a shingle or a cheese box on a raft. Her armor was 9 inches thick in critical locations and nowhere less than 5, which would give her an advantage over her thinner-skinned opponent. The factors that made her truly the David to meet Goliath, however, were her 12-foot draft and her high maneuverability, which would combine her heavy punch with light, fast footwork. Her 60-man crew, men of war's men all, had volunteered directly from the fleet, and "a better one no naval commander ever had the honor to command," her captain said. His name was John L. Warden, a 44-year-old lieutenant with 28 years in the service. He had been given the assignment, admittedly no plum, after 7 months in a rebel prison, the result of having been captured back in April while trying to return from delivering secret messages to the Pensacola squadron. Obviously, he was a man for desperate ventures, and perhaps the department heads believed his month's endurance would make him extra anxious to hit back at the people who had held him. If they thought so, they were right. 9 days after the Monitor was commissioned, he took her south for Hampton Roads. Having weathered the storm, Warden rounded Cape Henry near sundown Saturday and heard guns booming 20 miles away. He guessed the cause and cleared for battle. But when he passed the riprap just before moonrise and proceeded up the brightly lighted roadstead, each wave crest a sparkle with reflections of the flame-wrapped Congress, all he saw of the Virginia was the damage she had done. 1 ship sunk, another burning, and 3 more run ingloriously aground. An account of what had happened quickly told him what to do. Believing the Virginia would head first for her next morning, he put the Monitor alongside the Minnesota, kept his steam up, and waited. Dawn came, and at 7:30 he saw the big rebel ironclad coming straight for his stranded charge, whereupon he lifted anchor, darted out from behind the screening bulk of the frigate, and steamed forward to the attack. The monitor's sudden appearance was as unexpected as if she had dropped from the sky or floated up from the harbor bottom, squarely between the Virginia and her intended prize. "I guess she took us for some kind of a water tank," one of the monitor crewmen later said. "You can see surprise in a ship just as you can see it in a man, and there was surprise all over the Merrimack." He was right, or almost right. Instead of a water tank, however, we thought at first it was a raft on which one of the Minnesota's boilers was being taken to shore for repairs, a Virginia midshipman testified, and when suddenly a shot was fired from her turret, we imagined an accidental explosion of some kind had taken place on the raft. This mistake was not for long. Rumors of work in progress had been trickling south as well as north, and the monitor was recognized and saluted in her own right with a salvo which broke against her turret with as little effect as the ones that had shattered against the armored flanks of the Virginia yesterday, when the superiority of iron over wood was first established. Now it was iron against iron. The monitor promptly returned the fire, swinging her two guns to bear in rapid succession. The fight was on. It lasted 4 hours, not including a half-hour midway intermission, and what it mainly showed, in addition to its reinforcement of what one of them had proved the day before, that wooden navies were obsolete, was that neither could sink the other. The monitor took full advantage of her higher speed and maneuverability, of her heavier, more flexible guns, and particularly of her lighter draft, which enabled her to draw off into the shallows for a breather where the other could not pursue. The Virginia's supposed advantages, so impressive to the eye, were in fact highly doubtful. Her bigness, for example, the Colossus of Rhodes, one northern correspondent dubbed her, only made her more sluggish and easier to hit, and her eight guns were limited in traverse. The effectiveness of her knockout punch, demonstrated yesterday when she rammed the Cumberland, was considerably reduced by the loss of her iron beak. Also, she had come out armed for the destruction of the frigates. Her explosive shell shattered easily against an armored target, and she had brought only a few solid rounds to be used as hot shot. Worden's task, on the other hand, was complicated by the need for protecting the grounded Minnesota, which the Virginia would take under fire if he allowed her to get within range. Then, too, his gun crews were disconcerted by whizzing screwheads that flew off the inner ends of the armor bolts and rattled about inside the turret whenever the enemy scored a direct hit. Buchanan gone, command of the Virginia had passed to her executive, Lieutenant Catesby Appar Jones. He gave the monitor everything he had given the wooden warships yesterday, and more, to no avail. When he tried to ram her, she drew aside like a skillful boxer and pounded him hard as he passed. After a few such exchanges, the crews of his afterguns, deafened by the concussion of 180-pound balls against the cracking railroad iron, were bleeding from their noses and ears. Descending once to the gun deck and observing that some of the pieces were not engaged, Jones shouted, "Why are you not firing, Mr. Eggleston?" The gun captain shrugged. "Why, our powder is very precious," he replied, "and after 2 hours' incessant firing I find that I can do her about as much damage by snapping my thumb at her every 2 minutes and a half." At this point, the monitor hauled off into shallow water, where she spent 15 minutes hoisting a new supply of shot and powder to her turret. Left alone, the Virginia made one of her drawn-out turns to come as near as possible to the grounded Minnesota, whose captain received her with what he called a broadside which would have blown out of the water any timber-built ship in the world. Unwincing, the ironclad put a rifled bow-gun shell into her and was about to swing broadside, bringing all her guns to bear, when the monitor came steaming out of the shallows and intervened again, Worden having refreshed himself with a stroll on the deck and a general look round, while the fresh supply of ammunition was being made handy for his guns. The two ironclads re-engaged. Jones by now had decided that if he was going to destroy his foe, it would have to be with something other than his guns. First he tried ramming, despite the absence of his iron beak, but the monitor was too spry for him. The best he could manage was a blunt, proud, glancing blow that shivered her timbers. A tremendous thump, one of her officers called it, but did her no real damage. The smaller ship kept circling her opponent, pounding away, one crewman said, like a cooper with his hammer going round a cask. Doubly frustrated, Jones then determined to try an even more desperate venture, one that would bring his crew's 5-to-1 numerical advantage to bear. Having taken naval warfare a long stride forward yesterday, today he would take it an even longer one, back to the pistol and cutlass days of John Paul Jones. He would board his adversary. Equipping his men with tarpaulins for blinding the monitor's gun slits and iron crows for jamming her turret and prying open her hatch, he had them stand by the sally ports while he maneuvered to get within grappling distance. It was a risky plan at best, far riskier than he knew. The federal gunners were supplied with hand grenades for just such an emergency. Yet it might have worked if he could only have managed to bring the Virginia alongside. He could not. Nimble as a skittish horse, the smaller vessel danced away from contact every time. For 2 more hours, this second act of the long fight continued, and all this time the monitor was pounding her opponent like an anvil, cracking and breaking her armor plate, though not enough to penetrate its 2-foot oak and pitch-pine backing. Soon after noon, in a last attempt at boarding, though by now the Virginia's stack was so riddled that her fires could get almost no draft, and her speed, already slow, was cut in half, Jones brought his ship within 10 yards of the enemy and delivered at that point-blank range a 9-inch shell, which exploded against the pilot house, squarely in front of the sight slit where Warden had taken station to direct the helm and relay fire commands. The concussion cracked the crossbeam and partly lifted the iron lid, exposing the dark interior. Warden was stunned and blinded, ears ringing, beard singed, eyes filled with burning powder, but not too stunned to feel dismay, and not so blind that he did not see the sudden glare of the noonday sky through the break in the overhead armor. "Sheer off," he cried, and the helmsman put her hard to starboard, running for the shallows. While the monitor retired to shoal water and remained there to assess the damage she and her captain had suffered, the Virginia steamed ponderously across the deep water battle scene with the proud air of a wrestler who has just thrown his opponent out of the ring. Presently, however, the ebb tide was running, keeping her out of range of the Minnesota, and she had settled considerably as a result of taking water through her seams. She drew off south across the roads for Norfolk, claiming victory. As she withdrew, the monitor came forward and took her turn at dominating the scene, basing her victory counterclaim on the fact that the Virginia did not turn back to continue the fight. This would result in much argument all around, though privately both antagonists admitted the obvious truth, that tactically the fight had been a draw. In a stricter sense, the laurels went to the monitor for preventing the Virginia from completing her mission of destruction. Yet in the largest sense of all, and equally obvious, both had been victorious over the wooden navies of the world. Stretched out on the sofa in his cabin, Warden was a ghastly sight, according to the executive who went to receive instructions from him upon assuming command. When the captain could speak, lying there with his beard singed, his face bloody, and his eyes tight shut as if to hold the pain in, his first words were a question. "Have I saved the Minnesota?" "Yes," he was told, "and whipped the Merrimack." "Then I don't care what happens to me," he said. As it had a perverse tendency to do in times of crisis, the telegraph line to Washington from Fort Monroe had gone out that Sabbath morning, and it stayed dead till just past 4 that afternoon. During all this long, exasperating time, among all the officials waiting fidgety behind the soundproof curtain, which sealed them off from news of the fight at Hampton Roads. None awaited the outcome with a deeper concern than George McClellan. The campaign he was about to launch depended on the Federal Navy's maintaining domination of the bays and coastal rivers north of the James. It required very little imagination, far less at any rate than McClellan was blessed or cursed with, to picture what would happen if enemy gunboats, even wooden ones, let alone the frigate-killing Merrimack, Virginia, got among his loaded transports on their way down Chesapeake Bay or up the Rappahannock River. Before news of the ironclad duel reached Washington, however, he received outpost dispatches which shipwrecked the Urbana plan as completely as the sinking of the Monitor would have done. Joe Johnston was gone from the Manassas line. Most of his army was already back on the banks of the Rappahannock, entrenching itself near the very spot McClellan had picked for a beachhead. To land at Urbana now, he saw, would be to land not in Johnston's rear, but with Johnston in his own. Despite this abrupt and, so to speak, ill-mannered joggling of the military chessboard after all the pains he had taken to dispose the pieces to his liking, he was nonetheless relieved when, immediately following the news of Johnston's retrograde maneuver, the wire from Fort Monroe came suddenly alive with jubilant chatter of a victory by stalemate. The rebel ironclad had gone limping back to Norfolk, neutralized. He could breathe. What was more, he saw in this new turn of events an opportunity to put the finishing touch to his army's rigorous 8-month course of training. A practice march, deep into enemy territory, under combat conditions, with full field equipment and carefully worked out logistics, and then another march right back again, since there was nothing there that he would not gain automatically and bloodlessly by going ahead with his roundabout plan for a landing down the coast. Warning orders went out that night, alerting the commanders. Next day, the troops were slogging south, well-ordered dark blue columns probing the muddy North Virginia landscape. Excellent as this was as a graduation exercise to cap the Army's basic training program, it had a bad effect on the public's opinion of Little Mac as the man to whip the rebels. Armchair strategists found in it the answer to the taunting refrain of a current popular song. "What are you waiting for, tardy George?" What he had been waiting for, apparently, was the departure of Johnston's army, which he had not ventured to risk encountering face to face. There was truth in this, though it omitted the balancing truth that, however frightened he might have been of Johnston, the thing he had least wanted was for Johnston to be frightened of him. Frightened, that was, into pulling back and thus eluding the trap McClellan had spent all these months contriving. Lacking this restricted information, all the public could see was that tardy George had delayed going forward until he knew there was nothing out there on the southern horizon for him to fear. The outrage was screwed to a higher pitch when reports came back from newspapermen who had marched with the army through the supposedly impregnable fortifications along the Centerville Ridge, where Quaker guns had been left in the embrasures to mock the Yankees. "It was Munson's Hill all over again," the correspondents cried. "Our enemies, like the Chinese, have frightened us by the sound of gongs and the wearing of devil's masks." What was more, the smoldering wreckage of the Confederate camps showed conclusively that Johnston's army had been no more than half the size McClellan estimated. "Utterly dispirited, ashamed, and humiliated," one reporter wrote, "I return from this visit to the rebel stronghold, feeling that their retreat is our defeat." The feeling was general. "It was a contest of inertia," another declared. "Our side outsat the other." These were non-professional opinions, which in general the army did not share. Civilians liked their victories bloody, the bloodier the better, so long as the casualty lists did not touch home. Soldiers, except perhaps in retrospect, when they had become civilians too, preferred them bloodless, as in this case. The Centerville fortifications looked formidable enough to the men who would have had to assault them, peeled log guns or no. Besides, some of them, old-timers now, could contrast this march with the berry-picking jaunt which had ended so disastrously in July. It went smoothly, with a minimum of stop and go. There was no need to fall out of column when everything a man could want was right there in the supply train. They were an army now, and they looked it, in their manner and their dress. There were still a few outlandish Zouave outfits to lend the column sudden garish bursts of color like mismatched beads on a string, but for the most part they wore the uniform which had lately become standard. Light blue trousers and a tunic of dark blue, with a crisp white edge of collar showing just under the jowls of the men in regiments whose colonels, being dudes or incurable old army martinets, preferred it so. Whatever truth there might once have been in the Confederate claim that Southerners made better soldiers, or anyhow started from a better scratch because they came directly from life in the open and were familiar with the use of firearms, applied no longer. After 6 months of army drill, a factory hand was indistinguishable from a farmer. Individually, the Northerners knew, they were at least as tough as any men the South could bring against them, and probably as a whole they were better drilled. Except, of course, the cavalry, since admittedly it took longer to learn to fork a horse in style. McClellan's men were aware of the changes he had wrought, and they were proud of them. But the thing that made them proudest of all was the sight of Little Mac himself. He was up and down the column all that day, glad to be out from under the shadow of the Capitol dome and the sneers of the politicians, not answering ignorant questions or countering even more ignorant proposals, but returning the cheers of his marching men with a jaunty horseback salute. Presently, crossing Bull Run by Blackburn's Ford, they came onto the scene of last year's smoky, flame-stabbed panorama. It was a sobering sight, for those who had been there then and those who hadn't. The corpse of a battlefield, silent and deserted except perhaps for the ghosts of the fallen. Shell-blasted, the treetops were twisted in 100 directions as though struck by lightning, one correspondent wrote. Manassas Junction lay dead ahead, the embers of it anyhow, at the base of a column of bluish-yellow smoke, and off to the right were the tumbled bricks of Judith Henry's chimney, on the hill where the Stonewall Brigade had met the jubilant attackers, freezing the cheers in their throats, and flung them back. Jeb Stuart's horsemen had come with a thunder of hoofs, hacking away at the heads of the New York Fire Zouaves. All that was left now was wreckage, the charred remains of a locomotive and 4 freight cars, 500 staved-in barrels of flour, and 50-odd barrels of pork and beef scattered around in the mud. McDowell was there at the head of his corps, and one of his soldiers wrote that he saw him weeping over the sun-bleached bones of the light-hearted berry-picking men he had led southward under the full moon of July. McClellan was not weeping. This field held no memories for him, sad or otherwise, except that what had happened here had prompted Lincoln to send for him to head the army he found cowering on the banks of the Potomac, and later to replace Scott as chief of all the nation's armies. He went to bed that night, proud to have taken without loss the position McDowell had been thrown back from after spilling on it the blood of 1,500 men. Next day he was happy still, riding among the bivouacs, but the day that followed was another matter. He woke to find his time had come to weep. Once more he had turned his back on Lincoln, and once more Lincoln had struck with a war order. This one, numbered 3, relieved McClellan as general-in-chief and left him commanding only the Department of the Potomac, one of 7 in the Eastern Theater. The worst of it, in damage to his pride, was that he learned of the order not through military channels, but by a telegram from friends in Washington who read it in the papers. Stanton's office had leaked the order to the press before forwarding it to McClellan in the field. Within 1 week of learning that his commander-in-chief had listened to charges of treason against him, of being forced to reorganize his army on the eve of committing it to action under corps commanders who had gone on record as being opposed to his military thinking, he was toppled unceremoniously from the highest rung of the professional ladder. This was hard. Indeed, it might have been the crowning blow, except that later that same day, March 12th, he was comforted by a mutual friend whom the president sent with the full text and an explanation of the order. He was relieved of the chief command until otherwise ordered, it read, which implied that the demotion was temporary. Furthermore, the envoy explained, the order had been issued primarily to allow him to concentrate without distractions on the big campaign ahead. McClellan took heart at this and wrote to Lincoln at once, informing him that, "I shall work just as cheerfully as before, and that no consideration of self will in any manner interfere with the discharge of my public duties." So he said, and doubtless believed. He would have been considerably less cheerful, though, if he had known of other things that were happening behind his back this same week in Washington. That sink of iniquity, he called it. Ethan Allen Hitchcock, a 64-year-old Vermonter, West Point graduate and veteran of the Seminole and Mexican Wars, was surprised to receive from the War Department in mid-March a telegram summoning him to Washington. He had been retired from the Army since 1855 and never would have entered it in the first place if his parents had not insisted that the grandson and namesake of the hero of Ticonderoga was obliged to take up arms as a profession. Hitchcock's principal interests were philosophy and mysticism. He considered himself a scholar rather than a warrior, and had written books on Swedenborg and alchemy and Jesus. His first reaction to the summons that plucked him from retirement was a violent nosebleed. He got aboard a train, however, suffering a second hemorrhage on the way and a third on arrival, each more violent than the one before. Checking into a Washington hotel, he took to the bed in a dazed, unhappy condition. Presently, the Secretary of War was at his bedside. While the old soldier lay too weak to rise and greet him, Stanton told him why he had been sent for. He and Lincoln needed him as a military adviser. The air was thick with treason. Before Hitchcock could recover from his alarm at this, the Secretary put a question to him. Would he consider taking McClellan's place as commander of the Army of the Potomac? Hitchcock scarcely knew what to make of this. Next thing he knew, Stanton had him out of bed and on the way to the White House, where Lincoln repeated the secretary's request. Badly confused, Hitchcock wrote in his diary when he got back to his room that night, "I want no command. I want no department. I am uncomfortable." Finally, he agreed to accept an appointment as head of the Army Board, made up of War Department bureau chiefs. In effect, this amounted to being the right-hand man of Stanton, who terrified him daily by alternately bullying and cajoling him. He was perhaps the unhappiest man in Washington. Unsuspecting that the President and the Secretary of War were even now casting about for a replacement for him, McClellan completed his Army's graduation exercise by marching it back to its starting point, Fairfax Courthouse, to deliver the baccalaureate address. After congratulating his soldiers on their progress, he announced that their long months of study were behind them. He was about to take them where you all long to be, the decisive battlefield. In solicitude, he added, "I am to watch over you as a parent over his children, and you know that your general loves you from the depths of his heart. It shall be my care, as it ever has been, to gain success with the least possible loss. But I know that if necessary you will willingly follow me to our graves for our righteous cause. I shall demand of you great heroic exertions, rapid and long marches, desperate combats, privations, perhaps. We will share all these together, and when this sad war is over we will return to our homes and feel that we can ask no higher honor than the proud consciousness that we belonged to the Army of the Potomac." With their cheers ringing in his ears, he turned at once to perfect his plans for a landing down the coast. Urbana was out, but Mobjack Bay and Fort Monroe were still available. In fact, though he had pronounced these alternatives less brilliant, by which he meant that they would not outflank the enemy, neither Johnston to the north nor Magruder to the south, now that he came to examine it intently, Fort Monroe had definite advantages Urbana had not afforded. For one thing, the beachhead was already established. Old Point Comfort having been held throughout the secession furor despite the loss of Norfolk across the way. For another, during his advance up the York James Peninsula toward Richmond, his flanks would be protected by the Navy, which could also assist in the reduction of any strong points he encountered within range of its big guns. The more he studied the scheme, the better he liked it. By now, however, he had learned to look back over his shoulder. Lincoln had to be considered, not only considered, but outmaneuvered. Once before, he had accomplished this by calling a conference of his generals and confronting the president with their concerted opinions as to the soundness of a military plan. In that case, Lincoln had not dared to override him, nor would he now. So McClellan called his corps commanders together there at Fairfax and presented them with his proposal for a landing at Fort Monroe. Having heard him out, the four generals expressed unanimous approval, provided four conditions could be met. These were that the Merrimack could be kept out of action, that there were sufficient transportation facilities to take the army down the coast, that the Navy could silence certain fortifications on York River, and that enough troops were left behind to give the capital an entire feeling of security for its safety from menace. They were not in full agreement as to how many men would be needed to accomplish this last condition, but their estimates ran generally to 40,000. McClellan had them put their approval in writing that same March 13th, then sent McDowell to Washington to present it to Stanton and Lincoln. As soon as McDowell had had time to get there, McClellan received a wire from Stanton. McDowell had shown up with a paper signed by the corps commanders. Did McClellan intend for the plan it approved to be taken as his own? McClellan replied that it did. After another interval, allowing time for the secretary and Lincoln to confer, a second Stanton telegram arrived. Lincoln did not exactly approve. Rather, as Stanton phrased it, he made no objection, so long as enough of McClellan's men were left behind to keep Washington and Manassas safe while the army was down the coast. The final paragraph, which made consent explicit, was petulant and sneering. Move the remainder of the force down the Potomac, choosing a new base at Fortress Monroe or anywhere between here and there, or at all events, move such remainder of the army at once in pursuit of the enemy by some route. Perhaps by now McClellan had learned to abide the tantrums and exasperations of his former friend and sympathizer. At any rate, having won the consent he sought, he could overlook the tone in which it was given. However, that Manassas, too, was to be afforded what the generals called an entire feeling of security, imposed an additional manpower drain on which he had not counted. He was tempted to give Lincoln another tactics strategy lecture, proving that the place would be in no danger, and in fact of small importance once his landing on the peninsula had drawn Johnston's army farther south to oppose his swoop on Richmond. But there was too much else to do just now. He had no time for arguments and lectures. The transports were being assembled at Alexandria, 113 steamers, 188 schooners, and 88 barges, by far the largest amphibious expedition the hemisphere had ever seen, to take his army down the Virginia coast with all its equipment and supplies, guns and wagons, food and ammunition, horses and beef cattle, tents and records, all the impedimenta required to feed, clothe, and arm 146,000 men. They were to move in echelons of 10,000 on a schedule designed to complete the shuttle within 3 weeks. McClellan worked hard and long, giving the loading his personal attention. Within 4 days of receiving Lincoln's approval, or anyhow what amounted to approval, he stood on an Alexandria wharf and saw the first contingent off on its journey south. "The worst is over," he wired Stanton. "Rely upon it that I will carry this thing through handsomely." Such optimistic expressions by the young Napoleon were usually precursors of disappointment or disaster. Not only was this one no exception, it had in fact a double repercussion, set off in his rear by two men who opposed McClellan as well as each other. Stonewall Jackson, who had done so much to wreck McDowell on Henry Hill, and John Charles Fremont, who had done so much, though with less success, to damage Lincoln in Missouri. The two blows landed in that order, both before the Army of the Potomac had completed its roundabout journey down Chesapeake Bay. The first echelon left Alexandria on March 17th, a Monday. Before the week was up, Jackson stabbed hard at the troops McClellan had left behind, in accordance with Lincoln's concern, to block any Confederate drive on Washington through the Shenandoah Valley. That corridor pointed shotgun-like at the Union solar plexus. When Johnston fell back to the Rappahannock, he instructed Jackson to conform by retreating southward up the valley in event of a Federal push, taking care meanwhile to protect the main army's western flank by guarding the eastern passes of the Blue Ridge. Jackson, of course, obeyed, but not without a plea that he be allowed at least a chance to hurt the man who pushed him. As he put it, "If we cannot be successful in defeating the enemy, should he advance, a kind providence may enable us to inflict a terrible wound and effect a safe retreat in the event of having to fall back." Old Blue Light, his soldiers called him. They had seen the fire of battle in his eyes. He read the New Testament in his off hours, but did his military thinking in accordance with the old, which advised smiting the enemy hip and thigh, and assured the assistance of Providence in the infliction of terrible wounds. At any rate, he soon had the chance he prayed for. When Johnston fell back, the Federals came forward, two divisions of them marching up the valley in cooperation with McClellan's excursion east of the mountains. Jackson, with 4,600 men, retreated wildly.